This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 51, Poppy Vandermeerva, part 2. In episode 50, I began telling you the story of a 3-year-old girl named Poppy Vandermeerva, whose utterly preventable death in October of 2016 shocked the nation of South Africa. After multiple reports that Poppy and her 5-year-old brother were being abused, social services became involved, but the family moved to avoid the investigation. 3 weeks later, Poppy was dead, and in this episode, I'll go over the events that followed the arrests of both her stepfather and her mother. This is the story of the murder of a blonde, blue-eyed little doll whose smile stole the hearts of an entire country. It's also the sadly familiar story of the failure of an agency tasked with protecting children, despite countless warning signs and multiple reports from those close to the family. This is part 2 of the heartbreaking story of Poppy Vandermeerva. My sources for this week were the same as last week: the Pretoria News, the Randfontein Herald, News 24, ENCA, Independent Online or IOL, the Pretoria Record, All Four Women, The Ridge Times, Truth and Justice Continue Facebook page, The Citizen, SABC News, Marula Media, Wikipedia, The Guardian, and Court Testimony. If you haven't listened to Part 1 yet, I recommend going back and listening to Episode 50 before continuing with this one. Since so many of the news articles and nearly all of the court testimony was translated from Afrikaans, I apologize for any translation errors or mispronunciations. Before I get into the second half of Poppy's story, I'd like to give a shout-out to my newest patrons, Liz from Clealum, Washington, Raven from Austin, Texas, and Rachel from Elm Grove, Louisiana. Thank you all so much for your monthly pledges. Every pledge brings me closer to my goal of devoting myself full-time to the podcast and to SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com on a permanent basis, and your support means everything to me. If you'd like to become a patron, you can visit www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com and click Become a Patron in the upper right corner. Again, at some point, I'm hoping to make bonus content for my patrons, so thank you again for your patience while I try to get myself far enough ahead to make that happen. I also just wanted to mention that if you've sent me a case suggestion I haven't covered yet, it's not because I don't want to. It's just that I can't keep up with all the stories I'm sent or find on my own. I try to cover the stories of kids whose deaths haven't gotten as much media attention as others because they all deserve to be remembered, but there are just so many of them that I literally can't cover them all. I'm going to give it my best shot, though. Now let's get into the second half of Poppy's story. Where I left off last week, both Cobus Kokemoor, Poppy's stepfather, and Louisa Kokemoor, her mother, had been arrested for murder after the 3-year-old's death from blunt force trauma to the head on October 25th, 2016. Both Cobus and Louisa were held without bail. Multiple family members, including Louisa prior to her arrest, had granted interviews to various media outlets. In her interview, Louisa laid the blame for Poppy's murder squarely at the feet of her husband, Cobus, saying he had assaulted Poppy both the night before her death by slamming her head into the kitchen cupboards and the day of, when she said he kicked Poppy in the stomach as she lay, ailing, on the floor in front of the TV. While in jail awaiting trial, Louisa and Cobus wrote to each other. Louisa's defense team took possession of the letters in her cell that Cobus wrote, but activists were able to obtain 4 letters Louisa wrote to Cobus on toilet paper from her holding cell in Brits in the Northwest province of South Africa. The 4 letters in sequence read like a bad melodrama and display the disintegration of the murderous couple's marriage. The first letter seemed to point the finger of blame directly at Cobus.
"My dearest love, Cobus. I don't know what went wrong in your life, so much so that your own family do not support you. This makes me wonder why they don't want to help you. My love, this is how I see what went wrong. You have singled out Poppy. She could do nothing right in your eyes. Whenever you had the chance, whenever you were not hitting her, you bullied her. Just think for a moment. You pushed her around, picked her up by her hair, and threw her against a cupboard. The moment I tried to approach you about this, you acted as if you had done nothing? I believe in this way, you slowly murdered her day by day. JV and I lived in fear of you. I am to blame for not stepping in and stopping you, but I was so afraid of you, and I was scared, so much so that I thought you would kill both JV and I.
These letters are translated from Afrikaans, so if they don't sound altogether natural, I'm sure it's just a translation issue. The second letter had a very different tone.
To my dearest husband, I am so truly in love with you. You don't believe me when I say I will not divorce you. You are breaking my heart, but that is okay. I should have expected it from you. It will always be a struggle to convince you that I love you and that you can trust me and believe in me again. I will never get out of here now. They all believe I killed Poppy. I don't want to have your death on my conscience as well, because they will say it is also my fault. It is already my fault that you were inside. I am where the Vandermeervas want me. I never thought they would go so far. I will say I killed her, although I know I have not, so that you can get out of here to live your life to the fullest. My life is over and nobody cares. You don't need me. You can still find a wife and live a happy life out there. I will retract everything I have said and will say I killed her.
The third letter was short, but nauseating.
I need you desperately. Thank you for all your love and words of hope, my angel, and thanks again for this wonderful letter, my love. Sorry, my dearest love, angel. I love you so much and miss you badly. I promise that I will wait for you, my love. Please, eat, my angel, please. Promise me. Yes, I do have hope, but seeing is believing. Sorry, but I do doubt a little bit, my angel. Love, your wife, Louisa.
The fourth letter drips with self-pity.
My dearest Cobus, you will believe in any case what you want to believe, and I will tell you now, I am being charged with murder, and I will not get out of here just like you. According to the court, I have allowed you to kill my child, and I have done nothing to stop it, therefore I am just as guilty as you are. Oh yes, I will never have a wonderful life in here. The jail, my tears and love mean nothing to you. Sorry that I have troubled you. Please will you return all my letters, since it has meant nothing to you. I will appreciate it. I will never be the person I was before. If you ever hear that I have died in here, just know one thing. I have not committed suicide. I am too much of a coward and will never go that far. That will mean that you have got it right and got somebody to kill me here inside the jail. I am not the suicidal type. Sorry to disappoint you again. This is not something you like to hear. I will also not trouble you. This is something you want to hear. I hope that you're happy now. I will send you your stuff back.
In January of 2017, Poppy's father, Christo Vandermeerva, spoke with You magazine and provided them with a recording of his last conversation with Poppy, which he took during their Sunday phone call on July 31st, 2016. The call is in Afrikaans, but I wanted to play a clip so you could hear Poppy's sweet little voice. During the conversation, Poppy and her dad talk about what Poppy was doing, which was watching TV. Christo asked if she was growing up nicely, and Poppy replied,
"Yes, I'm the smallest."
She then told him she wanted to sing a popular Afrikaans children's song, and sang a short portion of the song.
Hallo, my meisie kind. Goed en jy? Wat maak jy?
Papa.
Ja?
TV.
Hoe kyk jy TV?
Ja.
Ja, my meisie kind. Ja. En word jy baie mooi groot?
Ja, my kind. Papa is klein.
Is jy klein?
Papa is klein. Ja.
Wow.
Papa wil handie slaan.
Dan gaan vir my handie slaan.
On January 24th, 2017, Cobus attempted suicide in jail, saying he had done it because his wife implicated him in Poppy's murder. Cobus slit his wrists that morning and was taken to the hospital under police guard. After the attempt to end his life, Cobus was nonetheless scheduled to appear in court the following day, after which he would be taken back to the hospital. During this hearing, both Cobus and Louisa were expected to reapply for bail. At the time, a petition on change.org was circulating, demanding that the defendants be granted no bail. By the time the petition closed, it garnered about 10,500 signatures. On January 25th, Kobus and Louisa Cocamore appeared for the first time together in the Brits Magistrates Court. The courtroom was once again full of supporters for the Justice for Poppy movement, as well as family members. Louisa entered first, followed by Kobus. Throughout most of the hearing, Louisa stared at the floor with her head down. By this time, Kobus' court-appointed attorney, advocate Mike Netchiawa, had withdrawn from the case, so Kobus applied at the hearing for further legal aid. He would soon be assigned another advocate. No bail was granted, and as expected, Kobus was returned to the hospital after the hearing, at which time the case was postponed. On February 16th, Louisa's mother, then 67-year-old Susan Bothma, spoke to U Magazine, telling them,
"I'm not doing well. I was very sick. My heart is not strong enough for all of this."
Due to backlash from the community, Susan said she would not be attending the upcoming court proceedings, explaining,
"It wrecks my nerves. It's not good for my health."
Susan told the journalist that Louisa was jailed in a different facility than Kobus, and that she was only permitted to visit her daughter twice a week for 30 minutes at a time. Saying Louisa only initially stayed in touch with Kobus to
get information out of him,
Susan claimed the couple no longer wrote letters to each other. She also said her son-in-law had tried to take his own life 3 times in jail. Of Kobus, Susan said,
"I don't even want to see him. I don't think of him as family. He is nothing to me. He's just a man who came into our lives and destroyed everything."
When asked if her daughter partook in the abuse of Poppy and her 5-year-old brother, Susan said Louisa gave her children regular hidings when they misbehaved, adding,
"Little ones are naughty. When they throw food around, they must be taught that it's ugly behavior. Like any mother, she needed to teach them the difference between right and wrong."
Susan said she missed her grandchildren terribly, especially Poppy.
"She always sang Kumbaya, my lord, to me. I miss that child so much."
At the beginning of the hearing on February 21, 2017, Louisa's lawyer, Adrian Nell, complained about the length of time the case was dragging on. He said he would bring an application to the next court date for the case to be struck off the roll if the arraignment wasn't finalized by then, which would mean Louisa and Kobus would have to be released. Prosecutor Advocate Hannah Conradi argued that the case had only been postponed to this date for further investigation to take place and to finalize the charges the accused would face in the High Court, where the case would ultimately be transferred.
"The dossier was sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions on February 6th. However, we haven't received the indictment yet and request postponement for that reason."
Nell replied,
"The DPP has had the dossier for 3 weeks. At the next appearance, we will bring an application to have the case removed from the roll."
At the same hearing, Kobus claimed he was receiving death threats in the cells at the Brits police station, and through his attorney at the time, asked to be moved to another station. The magistrate granted a further postponement and suggested Kobus's request be taken up with the investigating officer. Finally, in March, Louisa and Kobus appeared for the last time in Brits Magistrate Court to face their charges. The prosecutor had applied to centralize the couple's charges because the offenses took place in Brits, Orania, and Hopetown, and each had its own magisterial jurisdiction. At the March hearing, Advocate Conradi confirmed that the Director of Public Prosecution had given instructions for the charges to be centralized. According to charging documents, Kobus and Louisa Cocamore each faced 1 charge of murder, 2 counts of assault with the intent to seriously injure Poppy and her brother, and a charge of child abuse regarding Poppy, her brother, and their older sister. The document read,
"While the accused were husband and wife, they both had a legal duty to protect and nurture the children."
The case file detailed the accusations against the estranged couple.
"The teenager was chased out of the house and she went to live with her granny. She was forbidden to go home and the emotional and verbal abuse against her continued. Although the state does not really know the exact conditions, the accused, among others, shouted at, hit, kicked, pulled, or twisted the younger children's ears, turned the hose on them during freezing weather, cut off the girls' hair, and threw them against solid objects. During this period, the children regularly suffered injuries and had bruises. They also exhibited improper emotional behavior."
Louisa and Kobus would not enter their pleas of not guilty until just prior to their trial, which was scheduled to begin in the High Court in Pretoria on October 30th of the same year. On October 30th, 2017, the trial of Kobus and Louisa Cocamore, overseen by Judge Bert Bam, began in Gauteng High Court in Pretoria. The first witness for the state was Dr. Ethel Margaret Becker, who you might remember from episode 50, was the attending doctor from the clinic in Orania, who was asked by the OMR to examine Poppy and JV weekly after allegations of abuse surfaced. Dr. Becker testified to witnessing multiple injuries on various parts of Poppy's body, which she suspected to be caused by violence toward the little girl. She testified that she noted these injuries in Poppy's hospital file, but inexplicably did not report them to the OMR. A nurse also testified to suspecting the children were being abused, followed by Counselor Heidi Smith, the social worker from the Orania Social Council, or OMR. Heidi testified next about her role in the children's case and the investigation into the abuse, which began in April of 2016. Regarding the photos both Poppy's and JV's teachers claimed to have sent Heidi of the children's injuries, Heidi denied the existence of these photos, which were later introduced into evidence proving they did exist. Heidi claimed that she had requested assistance from the social worker in Hopetown, but Louise's attorney stated during cross-examination that no complaint about the abuse had been lodged with the police anywhere in the entire Northern Cape. He said the region's social worker was not informed of the alleged abuse and first read about it in the media. The judge was perplexed about why multiple professionals had seen clear evidence of abuse on both Poppy and JV and yet failed to contact authorities, saying they had a duty to notify the police but did nothing. In fact, the police were never notified about any abuse until Poppy was taken to the hospital already dead. Judge Bam told the witnesses,
"You people's conduct is just weird,"
exclaiming that he didn't know what was wrong with them. Esna Schumann, who ran the Hupplekin Daycare Center in Orania and taught Poppy for several months, also took the stand on day one of the trial, becoming emotional when she spoke about the injuries she remembered seeing and the photos she took and forwarded to Heidi Smith. The next day, Poppy's father released a statement, which, roughly translated, read,
"We are here for Poppy. We are looking for justice for the 3-year-old blue-eyed little girl let down by the world, and we want reassurance that the culprits will be sent to prison. But we're here for all the Poppies out there who are still alive. And if we look at yesterday's state witnesses, it's very clear that there should not only be 2 accused before the court, but 6. Who knows how many others have failed to reach out? Finally, we want every person who is aware of this type of situation to arise and actually do something about it. As human beings, we have an obligation to stand up for those who cannot stand up for themselves. If only one of these people who testified yesterday did the right thing, Poppy could still be alive today."
Another state's witness at the trial was Tanya Goosen, teacher and manager of the OMR Aftercare Center. She cared for JV in the afternoons from January through September of 2016. Tanya testified to the little boy's changing behavior, the sudden emergence of anger issues, multiple injuries she saw and photographed, and the horrific explanations JV gave for the bruises and cuts. She also told the court how JV had described the poplapel, or porridge spoon, his stepfather used to hit him and Poppy. Tanya also testified about JV coming to school in oversized girls' clothing and shoes. On cross-examination, Louisa's attorney squeezed in the excuse that Cobus would not allow Louisa to buy the children appropriate clothing, saying,
"They struggled, and their cafe closed because they were bankrupt."
The teacher replied with impressive vehemence,
"The cafe closed because they disappeared overnight. They just took the child out of my program and disappeared."
Advocate Nell argued that the family didn't technically move overnight. They obtained a moving truck, and they weren't told by social workers that they couldn't move to another town. Despite his weak rebuttal, the point had effectively been made. Dr. Richard Gumbu, the physician who attempted to treat Poppy on October 25, 2016, when she was brought into the Brits Hospital, but ultimately declared her dead on arrival, took the stand. He described for the court how Poppy was
covered in bruises,
so severe and widespread that even her private parts were swollen and bruised. Dr. Gumbu also testified about Cobus's story about how Poppy's injuries were incurred, changing from a whipping to a sudden collapse, as well as Cobus and Louisa's displeasure with the idea of the police being called after Poppy's death was pronounced. Next, paramedic Morris DeBeer testified about seeing Poppy arrive at the hospital and attempting to provide life-saving intervention, despite her obvious rigor mortis. He, too, talked about the multitude of injuries he saw covering Poppy's lifeless body. The following day, the court heard testimony from the Kokomor's former neighbor, Yako Rue, one of the real heroes of this story, and one of the only people who actively tried to save Poppy and JV from their horrific fate. By the time of the trial, Yako had moved to the Eastern Cape Province, and he rode a bus for over 11 hours from Port Elizabeth to Pretoria just to testify. Yako talked about his experiences living next door to Cobus, Louisa, and the children, testifying about the screaming and beatings he overheard through the walls, the injuries he saw on the children, the excuses Louisa gave for the injuries, and witnessing the incident during which Kobus soaked the children with a hose, accused them of inappropriate sexualized behavior, and forced them to shiver in the cold as punishment. He also testified to reporting suspected abuse to Heidi Schmidt on more than one occasion, but before he saw any action taken, the Kokomores abruptly moved away, thwarting any attempts to help Poppy and JV. One of South Africa's leading forensic pathologists, Professor Hart Simon, also testified during the Kokomore murder trial. Professor Simon had previously testified during the trial of famed athlete Oscar Pistorius for the murder of his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, a case that drew massive interest from all over the world. After studying post-mortem photos of Poppy and the autopsy report, Professor Simon compiled his own report as an expert in the field. Professor Simon refuted Kobus's claims that Poppy's bruises were caused by the rough ride in the back of the Bakkie on the way to the hospital, saying that many of the little girl's injuries were on parts of her body that would not likely have been affected by bumping around in the back of a vehicle. Instead, he testified, it was his opinion that Poppy's injuries were caused by direct violence, and stated that due to the pattern of her injuries, he suspected
non-accidental injury syndrome,
otherwise known as battered child syndrome. Poppy had clearly experienced abuse for a significant amount of time prior to her death. In a strategy we don't often see during trials in the United States, both Kobus and Louisa Kokomore took the stand in their own defense during their trial. As you might imagine, there were a lot of excuses given during their testimony. Kobus took the plunge first, saying that when he and Louisa moved in together, initially he doled out any necessary discipline because he was the father figure of the family. He said he had a closer bond with JV, while Louisa and Marlisa were closer with Poppy. When asked, he said that Marlisa moved out because she didn't get along with him. Regarding his discipline of the children, Kobus said,
"I first beat them with the flat hand, but they laughed at me and it made me angry. That's when I bought the pap spoon."
The spoon, which was entered into evidence, was described by reporters as being as large as an adult man's forearm and the spoon end as big as a hand. Things changed when he began employing the wooden spoon. The children no longer laughed at his beatings, Kobus said, saying he would hit them until they stopped crying.
They get a hiding until they remain silent and admit their mistake.
After someone reported possible abuse and the OMR got involved, Kobus said he left the discipline up to his wife. Poppy's broken foot, he claimed, occurred at the family's cafe.
"She must have sat on her foot and her foot was asleep. She then fell down the stairs when she stepped on the foot. I only saw the next day that there was something wrong with her foot."
That statement directly contradicted neighbor Yako Rue's account of the incident, which I mentioned in the last episode, but I'll quote his testimony again here for comparison. Yako testified that at about 9 p.m. on the evening in question,
"I only heard Mr. Kokomore shout at Poppy, 'You just climbed into bed to fucking cack in bed.'"
Yako said he heard a smack and then,
"She screamed blue murder. It is simply something you cannot describe."
Yako said the sound of the beating itself was drowned out by Poppy's screams. The next morning, Yako testified, Poppy's leg was cast in plaster, and when he asked what happened, Louisa again gave the excuse that the 3-year-old had fallen down the stairs. How would Kobus be unaware of the injury if Poppy's injury had been cast already? When questioned on the stand about the child abuse complaints in Orania, Kobus blamed it on the children being injured at school. He said they left Orania because there was a vendetta against him and social services wouldn't leave him alone. Regarding the day of Poppy's death, Kobus claimed his estranged wife was responsible for his 3-year-old stepdaughter's fatal injuries. It all began, he said, with potty training. Poppy was in the middle of the training process, and although she did not have frequent accidents, they would become angry when she did,
because then everything has to be cleaned.
Poppy, he said, had soiled her bed about 5 times since the family moved to Brits, which means the 5 accidents took place over a period of about 3 weeks. On the morning of October 25th, 2016, he said Poppy was eating breakfast in her room.
"My wife went to fetch her dish, and I just heard a terrible noise from the bedroom. I heard her shouting at Poppy, 'You cacked on your bed.' Next thing I saw, Poppy come flying out of the room on all fours as if she had been thrown. She hit her head against the wall, and when she tried to get up, she lost her balance and ran into the wall."
He continued,
"My wife was livid with Poppy."
After throwing her daughter from the bedroom, Kobus claimed, Louisa yanked Poppy up by the arm and threw her into the bathtub to hose her down. At that time, it was about 11 a.m., so he left for the shops, not returning until about 5 p.m.
"When I got back, I saw Poppy lying in the kitchen where the trash can was supposed to be. I asked my wife what was going on, and she said Poppy was playing dead again as she sought attention."
According to Kobus's testimony, he proceeded to go outside to light a braai fire, but Louisa called him inside shortly thereafter to tell him that Poppy wasn't breathing.
I rushed inside and shook her, but she did not wake up. I placed her in the bath and threw water over her. When she still did not wake up, my wife and I applied CPR, but eventually we gave up.
When their life-saving efforts proved fruitless, Cobus said, he loaded Louisa, JV, and Poppy into the back of the family's baccy and rushed Poppy to the hospital. On the way, he claimed, he drove at a high rate of speed, which caused Poppy's limp form to tumble around the back of the truck. When they reached the hospital, he said, he carried Poppy inside, crying and screaming for someone to help her. Louisa, he said, did not go inside the hospital. After Poppy was declared dead, he found Louisa standing next to the car and had to deliver the sad news to her. This contradicts the testimony of both paramedic Morris DeBeer and Dr. Gumbu, who both attended to Poppy in the hospital, and who both testified to seeing Louisa and a little boy standing nearby. Photos of Poppy's lifeless body presented as evidence revealed an emaciated little girl, covered in bruises, whose hair had been shorn to the skull. While Cobus viewed the photos, he showed no emotion. With all the video conferencing and virtual meetings going on these days, we all want to look our best. If you're like me, you're probably confused by all the different methods of teeth whitening on the market. Now that I'm partnering with Smile Brilliant, I've learned a few things that you might find helpful about home teeth whitening methods. For example, LED lights are a novelty item. Whitening strips neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars. Charcoal is abrasive and wears down your enamel. And whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. So if none of these miracle products really works, what does? The number one product recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray, which usually costs an arm and a leg because they require a dentist to make them by hand using a model of your teeth. With Smile Brilliant's Lab Direct process, you can get custom-fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without a single visit to the dentist. Using an exact model of your teeth, Smile Brilliant's lab technicians will handcraft your trays to give you the best possible whitening results. All you have to do is visit smilebrilliant.com, and when you order their system, make sure you use the coupon code CHILDREN at checkout for 30% off. When you receive the package from Smile Brilliant, it's really simple. You just make your dental impressions at home and return them using the prepaid envelope they provide you. In a matter of 1 week, Smile Brilliant will have your trays back in the mail. Using my coupon code, CHILDREN, means you're supporting me while saving a huge amount of money, so check out smilebrilliant.com today. The following day saw Louisa Cocamore take the stand, where she cried intermittently as she responded to questions on direct examination, telling a story of an emotionally abusive marriage to a man who terrorized her and her children. Before she and Cobus were married, Louisa said, he was strict with the children, but after they were married, he really let his hair down and began physically abusing them, threatening her never to tell anyone.
He threatened to kill me and said he knows how to hide a dead body.
Louisa testified that her new husband started beating her kids within a month or two of their wedding.
If they did something wrong in his eyes, he would beat them. He even kicked them on several occasions in their stomachs.
Multiple times, she said, Cobus slammed Poppy's head against the kitchen cabinets. Once, she saw him throw Poppy against the sofa's iron frame, and on another occasion, he shoved Poppy's head in the toilet and flushed. After the family moved from Orania to Britz, Louisa said, the beatings intensified, and the frequency with which Cobus slammed Poppy's head against the cupboards increased. When that happened, she said,
she usually cried, and I consoled her so that she could stop and not make him angrier.
When asked why she didn't intervene in these brutal attacks, Louisa replied,
I simply could not help Poppy, as I feared that he would beat her even more if I interfered.
Besides, she said, she never thought her husband would go as far as killing one of the children. She was even questioned about why she didn't obtain an interdict against Cobus as she had with Christo, and she responded with some limp excuse about how she was busy getting one but just didn't get it in time. When asked repeatedly why she didn't leave him as she had left her previous abusers, she either said she feared the repercussions of leaving him, or she simply didn't know. Recounting the events leading up to Poppy's death, Louisa testified,
the night before her death, he picked her up from where she was eating at a table and flung her head, with might, against the kitchen cupboard. This was because she ate too slow for his liking. She cried, and I consoled her. I asked if she was okay, but she did not answer.
The next morning, Louisa said, Poppy was unsteady on her feet and seemed disoriented, hardly speaking. At one point, she fell against the wall. The little girl wouldn't eat, and Cobus shouted at her for that. After he left for the shops, Louisa said Poppy and JV were watching television, and she could tell there was something wrong with Poppy, who hardly opened her eyes, but she did manage to tell her mother she didn't feel well. When Cobus returned, Pape was still lying on the carpet in front of the TV.
He asked me why she was still there, and I told him she was not feeling well. He then kicked her in the stomach.
After that, he tried to revive her in the bathtub with water, but she was already dead.
She never breathed again.
Cobus's attorney accused her of lying, saying she was the one who assaulted Poppy for months until her death. The state also accused her of lying, suggesting both she and Cobus had assaulted Poppy until she died. Judge Bam asked Louisa why, when she realized Poppy was seriously injured on the morning of her death, she didn't get help for her daughter. Louisa said she wanted to, but Cobus refused to take Poppy to the hospital and said,
"She is playing dead again,"
which Louisa said she often did after being assaulted. The judge asked if she might have been unconscious, and Louisa said perhaps, but she never checked. Both Marlisa and JV took the stand during the trial, but during their testimony, they were in a separate room so they were not forced to face their attackers. Media was also barred from watching the children's testimony, as they were both minors at the time, and therefore not allowed to be identified. JV's turn on the stand was particularly gut-wrenching as he told the court about seeing his little sister lying lifeless on her bed with her teddy bear next to her after their stepfather attacked her. He spoke of seeing his mother do nothing, standing in the bathroom doorway while Cobus tried to revive Poppy in the bathroom by pouring water over her. After Poppy died, JV said he was sad because
I could never play with her again.
Louisa's mother, Susan Bothma, also testified, standing up for her daughter. Susan said,
I just want to say that Louisa was never aggressive. She had always been a very gentle person. If someone did something wrong, she would first try to correct the person. So she tried to get him right before she would just have him prosecuted. This is how I taught her. If she's punished for it today, it's my fault.
Susan said she had always seen a loving relationship between Louisa and her children, and had never witnessed any physical abuse on Louisa's part.
If they were naughty, she would separate them and let them sit still.
About her son-in-law, Susan said,
Cobus made me understand from the start, after the wedding, that I no longer have a say in her life. Before that, we were very close to each other, and then I was prevented from visiting them. He did not want me to know what was going on in the household. When Louisa and I were talking on the phone, she had to turn on the phone speaker so he could hear what we're talking about.
She said Louisa was terrified of her husband, which was why she never told anyone about Cobus's abuse of her children. Once, Susan testified, after another family member's funeral, she bathed Poppy's brother and saw he had bruises on his backside. He told her Daddy Cobus had hit him.
I never spoke to Louisa about it. There was never an opportunity, as she was never allowed to spend much time with me.
She did admit there was plenty of time for Louisa to tell her about the abuse when she attended church with her mother without Cobus, but she did not do it because Cobus had threatened her. After seeing the bruises on JV's bottom, Susan said she told the minister of her church in Orania that she suspected Cobus was abusing her grandchildren.
He told me to leave it and not to interfere in their marriage.
When she spoke with OMR counselor Heidi Smith, Susan said, Heidi told her they were
working on the case.
Judge Bam asked Susan,
So this simply went on for months?
Susan, who also lived in Orania, replied,
I do not want to speak badly of the place, but the processes there take a very long time.
She said she had no idea the family was moving from Orania to Britz a few weeks before Poppy died.
My daughter phoned me the day after they had moved and told me she did not know where she was, but that she was somewhere in the bush.
When Susan stepped down, both sides rested, and immediately afterward, the judge allowed closing arguments to begin. Public prosecutor Salome Schapers said that regardless of who delivered the final blow, both Cobus and Louisa were equally guilty under the doctrine of common purpose, which essentially means that if two or more people agree to commit a crime or associate in a joint unlawful enterprise, each is responsible for the acts of the others.
They were the only people there. They had a common purpose to kill her.
Cobus's attorney, advocate Lana Augustine, argued that the state had not proved that he could have foreseen Poppy's death. Adrienne Nels, Louisa's lawyer, argued that she was, at most, negligent. During his ruling, Judge Bam described the photos of Poppy as
absolutely shocking,
saying they proved to him that Poppy had been assaulted for some time before becoming unconscious. Regarding the defendant's claim that Poppy would play a game where she pretended to be dead, he said,
I don't believe this dead story for a minute. How can a 3-year-old pretend she's dead? She was probably unconscious.
In his opinion, the abuse intensified after the family moved to Britz because of the scrutiny of the authorities in Orania.
It seems that they wanted to catch up in Britz for what they could not do in Orania.
Judge Bam said there was no direct evidence pointing to who landed which blow, but it was clear to him that the
people in Orania did very little
about complaints that both children were abused for months.
It is shocking that they would cover up the abuse of children. It was clear that the children were being abused. the community failed for unknown reasons to take the necessary steps to protect the children. I'm surprised doctors, teachers, pastors, and counselors have just shifted the blame. These people could just as well have been accomplices.
Based on the evidence presented to him during the trial, Judge Bam found Louisa and Cobus guilty of murder and 2 charges of child abuse. Sentencing was scheduled for December 6, 2017, but it would be several more months before the Cocomores would learn their fate. The day after the conviction, Jaco Kleinhans, a spokesperson for Orania, told Marula Media,
"We are concerned about His Honorable Judge Bam's side remarks that Orania could have done more to protect Poppy. Numerous individuals and institutions were actively involved in the family's social problems, and we were touched on a deeply personal level by her murder. It is for us one of the greatest personal tragedies that this beautiful child was killed so brutally. Although Poppy was killed near Brits, the family lived in Orania until a month before the murder. Extensive counseling and monitoring processes took place over a period of months in Orania, and outside agencies were reached for assistance."
Kleinhans said urgent requests were made to the local Department of Social Development to remove the Cocomore children from the home,
unfortunately without the necessary preventative effect.
He claimed the OMR was told to follow that channel rather than reporting it to the police, and that since Poppy's death, the OMR contacted the Hopetown magistrate to set up more effective processes and channels to deal with and prevent similar cases in the future. Kleinhans blamed the course of events partly on a shortage of social workers, saying that Orania had been struggling for 2 years to hire a qualified social worker after the previous one resigned. Apparently, there was only 1 social worker for the entire town. Finally, Kleinhans said,
"Children are very precious to Orania, and our institutions do everything in their power to create a safe environment for them."
Also in December of 2017, the Go Purple Foundation, an organization supporting survivors of rape and sexual violence, which also acts when children are in need of care and protection, filed a criminal case of child abuse against 7 people they believed were complicit in Poppy's death. Founder Anari Duplessis, who was present at many of the court proceedings, spoke to Marula Media about the lawsuit, saying the unnamed individuals knew about Poppy's abuse,
but did not do enough to get her out of her situation, liberate, and protect.
Anari said the organization decided to make its voice heard against those
role players
who constantly
did not act in Poppy's best interests
and
knew of her condition but did nothing to prevent her horrific death. Poppy and the 6-year-old boy's behavior was indicative of the need to intervene. Her and the 6-year-old boy's bodies showed the extent of their horrific injuries, but the police were only involved after Poppy lay dead on a hospital table.
Anari said she believed that by not acting, the people named in the criminal charges were also to blame for Poppy's death.
"It is not a personal matter. Enough is enough. We cannot allow children to be abused or assaulted and then simply nothing is done about it. This is unacceptable. It is time for people to realize that there are consequences for their actions."
She said the Go Purple Foundation intended to have the charges investigated at a national level if none of the parties were prosecuted. In February of 2018, Granite Tombstones donated a beautiful headstone and grave cover for Poppy. The stone bore an engraving of Winnie the Pooh running toward a photo of Poppy with her arms outstretched. The headstone reads,
"Here lies our little angel, Louisa Poppy Vandermeerva."
The granite slab covering the grave reads,
"Poppy, you are now one of heaven's special little angels, a perfect little star in the night sky. And when you shine so bright that the whole world can see how beautiful you are."
When the tombstone was placed, Christo's parents, Johan and Carla, spoke to You Magazine. Carla, who did most of the talking, said,
"If there were a Winnie the Pooh in heaven, they would have played together."
She smiled a little while she recalled,
"You know, there were Winnie the Poohs on her bedding."
The Vandermeervas told the reporter they had called Louisa 2 days before Poppy's death to confirm the kids would be visiting them in December. When Louisa called them 2 days later to tell them Poppy had died, Carla handed the phone right back to Johan, and afterward, they drove 3 hours to give their son the horrible news in person. When sentencing was postponed, not for the first time, in mid-February, Carla said she wasn't bothered and that she was confident justice would be served, saying,
"God will also punish them."
When asked how she was doing, Carla said,
"We're not allowed to complain. The faster this case is over with, the better. My son is suffering. He's hurting about so many things. He is a broken man. But I'm here for him. Me, my husband, and my son are suffering. God will give us the strength to keep fighting and keep our heads up."
A court hearing was scheduled for February 27, 2018, during which Cobus apparently assumed he and Louisa would receive their sentences. That morning, in the holding cells at the Ha Tang High Court, sources said Cobus was drinking from a bottle containing foul-smelling, dark liquid, which he was believed to have started drinking en route from the jail to the courthouse. When the bottle was about half empty, Cobus collapsed. He was propped in a chair, looking unwell and throwing up. Judge Bam was apprised of the situation and postponed the hearing very briefly while an ambulance was called. A little over an hour later, Louisa appeared in court alone while Cobus waited for the ambulance. Prosecutor Shapers told the judge Cobus wasn't well, and she had gone down to the cells to check on him herself. She said she sniffed the bottle's contents and it smelled like some sort of detergent. As it turned out, Cobus's latest suicide attempt was all for naught. He survived, and besides, the purpose of the hearing was actually to push the sentencing back again because Cobus's attorney was sick. April 18, 2018 was set as the date when the defendants could submit their arguments to the court and call witnesses to testify in mitigation of sentence. When April 18th came, however, upon commencement of the hearing, Adrian Nell told the judge that an expert witness who had compiled a pre-sentencing report about Louisa was not willing to testify if her identity was not protected. Prosecutor Shapers said the state was unwilling to accept the report if she was unable to cross-examine the witnesses about its content and the woman's expertise, but she could not agree to the expert's anonymity because the law did not provide for expert witnesses to remain anonymous. Because of this, Advocate Nell told the court he would have to find a new expert witness, and Judge Bam agreed to reschedule the hearing yet again, this time to May 24th. Upon hearing this, Christo Vandermeerva burst into tears in the courtroom. Days after the aborted sentencing hearing, Inari Duplessis of the Go Purple Foundation once again spoke with Marula Media, telling the journalist she had received an email from the Hopetown Police informing her that the National Prosecuting Authority, or NPA, would not prosecute the seven individuals named in their criminal case because there could be
no prosecution on the current alleged charges.
Inari said their next step would be to request the National Prosecuting Authority to provide them with official notice of reasons for their decision. She said they would not give up because if they did,
children would never be helped. The law has loopholes. For example, it states that you are obliged to report abuse, but not that you will be prosecuted if it is not done.
Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find any further information on Inari's quest to pursue accountability for those who failed to intervene to protect Poppy. But because the Go Purple Foundation provides such important services, and because Inari and her volunteers have pushed very hard to get Poppy the justice she deserves, I had to include their efforts as part of Poppy's story. Sentencing for 47-year-old Louisa Cocamore and 44-year-old Cobus Cocamore finally took place on May 24, 2018, more than 5 months after their conviction. Louisa testified on her own behalf during the mitigation of sentence phase, breaking down several times while speaking. She said she had attempted to better herself in jail, joining church groups and prayer sessions, and she had even quit smoking. Louisa told the court that she was the product of a broken household and had been raped and molested by her stepfather over several years.
He made me believe it was my fault that he raped me.
She also reiterated that Cobus never hit her, only her kids. When the judge reprimanded her for never trying to report her husband's abuse of her children, Louisa said,
I feared for myself and my children's lives, and for those I would ask for help.
When asked if she regretted her inaction, Louisa said,
Yes, I am sorry. I am very sorry. I know I might have helped her more, but I was terrified and did not know what to do. I believe if I could have done something more, I would, but I did not know what to do. I was abused as a child, and know what it feels like to be abused. I told myself I would never raise my hands to my children.
Her lawyer told the judge Louisa had abused wife syndrome, which contributed to her acting passively.
She described her personal life. She had a difficult childhood and was in stormy relationships. There was no denying she's afraid of him.
When it was Cobus's turn to testify for his own mitigation of sentence, his attorney, Advocate Lana Augustine, said Cobus did not know his biological father at all during his childhood, and that after his mom remarried, his parents were very strict. His stepfather, she said, used corporal punishment and didn't show love. Since his conviction, she said, her client had been taking antidepressants, had suicidal tendencies, and experienced anxiety attacks. Public Prosecutor Shapers reminded the court,
Over a long period of time, two children were exposed to abuse in their own home where they were supposed to be safe. The accused did not regret it, but rather regretted that they had been caught and now had to go to jail. Poppy's body was covered with blue spots and bruises.
Judge Bam, another hero in this story, said both Cobus and Louisa were inherently evil, that they didn't show any remorse for Poppy's murder, and that they likely only regretted being caught. They showed little or no mercy to Poppy on the day of her death, and by the time they took her to the hospital, she had been dead for several hours. The judge was most aggravated by the months of abuse Poppy endured before her death, saying it began when she was only 2 years old. He said the assaults were so severe she probably lost consciousness based on Luisa's mentions of
playing dead
and mentioned how difficult it was to look at Poppy's post-mortem photographs, which showed brutal injuries that were violently inflicted. He said that both Luisa and Cobus had a duty to protect the children, but instead they ended up blaming each other, which indicated they were both aware of what was happening. Child abuse, Judge Bam admonished the convicted, was very serious, and even more so if the children were of a tender age.
It has become a common phenomenon that people kill each other and children. Child abuse cannot be tolerated and condoned in any society, and in my view, perpetrators of this must be removed from society for a very long time. But despite the severe sentence from the court, it seems abuse is on the rise.
At their ages, Judge Bam didn't believe Luisa and Cobus could be rehabilitated, and with that, he sentenced each of them to life in prison for Poppy's murder, with an additional 10 years added for the abuse of JV and Marlisa. When the sentence was announced, Carla Vandermeerva burst into tears of joy, another family member clapped her hands, and another waved her fist in the air. Speaking to reporters outside the courtroom, Carla said the family would now be able to pick up the pieces and try to move on with their lives, which had been burdened with grief since Poppy died. Her son, Christo, couldn't even attend the hearing, she said, because he couldn't handle the stress. He had suffered 2 anxiety attacks already that week.
I'm very relieved, and the sentence is right. Doesn't bring Poppy back, but we're relieved.
Also outside the courtroom, Findy Lau of the National Prosecuting Authority, who hugged the Vandermeervas after the hearing, said,
"This was an emotionally draining case. It was very difficult. As the NPA, we had to find motivation in that we intend delivering justice for these children who continue to be dependent on the criminal justice system to impose severe sentences in cases of this nature."
Adrian Nell seemed baffled that his client received a sentence as harsh as she did, saying,
"We are definitely shocked regarding the sentence, and I did receive instructions to appeal the sentence."
A few days after the sentencing, 33-year-old Sergeant Gift Matomi of the detective branch in Brits, the lead investigator on Poppy's case, spoke to U Magazine, saying,
"It was my job to get justice for Poppy, especially where her mother was concerned. I was never worried that she'd get away with it."
Poppy's case, Sergeant Matomi said, was the one that had made the most impact on him in his 12 years as a policeman.
"I asked myself, how many other children like Poppy are being abused? We need to look after our children to ensure no other child goes through what Poppy did. It's our responsibility as a society."
On July 30th, 2018, just 2 months after the sentencing, Poppy's paternal grandfather, Johan Vandermeerva, collapsed at home and was rushed to the hospital in critical condition. Sadly, he passed away the next day from internal bleeding. At the time, he and Carla were still fighting for custody of little JV. As it turned out, the internal bleeding was caused by what may have been a stress-induced bleeding ulcer. Since he showed no symptoms, there was no way to prevent it. Johan was cremated, and the family held a private memorial service to say goodbye to him. In August of 2019, it was announced that producer and director Francois Nolte had funded and created a short film about Poppy's story called Porcelain. The film follows a fictional detective as he investigates the events leading up to Poppy's death, giving a haunting, disturbing, but not overly graphic depiction of what Poppy went through in her final days. Nolte said,
"Poppy is, for me, the personification of a child who paid the absolute biggest price for a system that was broken. She was killed in the place where she should have been the safest, and no one came to her rescue, perhaps due to the fact that there were not enough social resources available, or perhaps because someone just did not do their job. But she paid with her life."
The director called the film a passion project and said it was his way of shedding light on the plight of thousands of children in South Africa who were suffering from similar physical and emotional treatment.
"Poppy's story shook the country, but the reality is that there are so many such cases that we do not even hear about. There are so many children paying the price for this flawed system that is not there to save them."
Nolte said the film is disturbing and not for everyone.
"Of course it is disturbing to see such things, and it is only human not to want to see them. But at the same time, we have to face this pain if we want to see change, if we want to put the spotlight on a system that fails children. And the only way we're going to do that is if the arts and the media create awareness about this."
I absolutely, positively could not agree more. That is exactly why I do what I do on this podcast and on the blog. Personally, I thought Porcelain was very well done, and I'll include a link to the film in my show notes for anyone interested in watching it. Also in August of 2019, Poppy's then 18-year-old half-sister, Marlisa, did an interview with You magazine, saying,
"I was like a mother to Poppy because our own mother could not look after her. I would rather have her than just a sister. That's why sometimes I can't help blaming myself or wondering if I could not have done something to save her life. But I was not her mom, because if I were, she might never have been kicked to death like a dirty beast. My mother's in prison, my sister is lying in a grave, and I am the one who still has to face life every morning."
Marlisa still hadn't forgiven her mother, saying,
"At her funeral, my mother and I cried together, but suddenly my tears made way for anger. I wanted to know how she could allow it. But she offered excuses, such as that she couldn't escape from him, that she was scared. When I was called to testify in court, I told the judge, 'Lock them up, they do not deserve freedom.' And I still feel that way."
The last time she saw her mother, Marlisa said, was in court. She had never visited Luisa in prison, although they talked once a week when her mother called from jail. Fortunately, Marlisa's outlook had started to improve.
"After Poppy's death, I was never the same again. I was afraid I would be half-human forever. But in the last few months, I have been able to breathe again for the first time and say, 'Marlisa, now you have to fight back against the things that are bothering you so much, for you and for Poppy.'"
Finally, also in August of 2019, shocking news broke that Lulu Vandermeerva, Christo's current wife, had pressed charges against him. Lulu's story was initially publicized by the Truth and Justice Continue Facebook page and later confirmed through an interview with news outlet IOL. Lulu, who had been present at most of the court proceedings throughout the prosecution of Luisa and Cobus for Poppy's murder, was not in attendance at the sentencing hearing, which she explained was because she could not appear in court with her face bruised.
"He again beat me 2 days before the sentencing. On the day of the sentencing, I told him I could not sit and watch him with the sentencing when I feel he should have been next to Cobus. I now understand why Luisa left him,"
Lulu told the reporter, adding that she was
"lucky to get out alive."
When she married Christo, Lulu told her mother she was marrying her best friend. His demeanor changed, however, after he lost his job in 2018. You might remember Luisa saying the exact same thing, that Christo became abusive after losing his job, leading to her leaving him. Lulu said,
"He sat at home for months, and he became more and more aggressive until he eventually started to physically assault me."
She said she left him in March of 2019 and hadn't had contact with him since. Currently, it does not appear that little JV, who is around the age of 10 now, lives with either his father or his grandmother, Carla. It is unknown where JV is living, but I hope with all my heart that he, Marlisa, and their older brother, Jaco Els, are all doing well and leading happy, healthy, abuse-free lives. After what Marlisa, and even more so JV, suffered under their mother and stepfather's care, they certainly deserve it. Poppy Vandermeerva's name and face are well known in South Africa. She will forever be frozen at the age of 3, captured only in photographs depicting a little blonde girl staring at the camera with big blue eyes. Like all of the stories I cover, it's beyond comprehension that anyone could look at that little face, look into those innocent blue eyes, and even consider raising a hand to hurt her. Even from halfway across the world, my heart is broken for this precious little girl who grew up surrounded by chaos and violence, but still, somehow, managed to share her insuppressible sunshine with everyone who encountered her. Rest in peace, Poppy. I hope you're sitting on your Grandpa Johann's knee and singing all the songs you ever wanted. You will never be forgotten. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.